Today we have the privilege of studying Perek Vav, 6th chapter of Sefer Yeshayahu, which is the Haftarah, in our custom, for Parashat Yitro. Parashat Yitro contains a narrative of God's appearance at Har Sinai, Ma'amad Har Sinai, and the giving of the Torah. And its central idea is the appearance of God to the people. And so our Haftarah echoes that theme, because it speaks about the appearance of God to the prophet Yeshayahu. Now, commentators have debated whether this is, in fact, historically the first chapter in Sefer Yeshayahu, or chronologically, is this the first chapter in Sefer Yeshayahu, or is it a chapter that happens in the middle of Yeshayahu's prophecy. Regardless of where you stand on that issue, this chapter, Perek Vav, the 6th chapter of Yeshayahu, is clearly contains a central message in Sefer Yeshayahu, and it begins with the statement that the prophet sees God. This, of course, is disturbing to Chazal and to the commentators, and Radak here quotes the Gemara in Chagiga, which compares the prophecy of Yechezkel and the prophecy of Yeshayahu. But more importantly, we note that the Gemara elsewhere in Yevamot tries to explain how could it be that a prophet sees God. And the Gemara there explains that a prophet can see God ba'aspaklaria she'ina me'ira, in a sort of mirror which does not give light, a mirror which gives shadows. In a sense, when the prophet sees God, what he is seeing is not a visual perception, but rather an idea of how God operates in the world. And it's with that in mind, that idea of understanding how God operates in the world, that we need to keep in mind as we look at this fascinating vision of a prophet who says that he sees God.
Bishnat mot ha-melech Uziyahu va'er'eh et Hashem yoshev al kisei ram v'nisa v'shulav mele'im et ha-heichal. In the year of the death of King Uziyahu, I saw God sitting upon a throne, high and mighty. His train filled the temple. Seraphim omdim mima'alo, shesh knafayim, shesh knafayim le'echad, bishtayim yechasef anav, uvishtayim yechasef raglav, uvishtayim ye'ofef. Seraphim were standing above him. Each one had 6 wings. With 2 wings, he would cover his face. With 2, he would cover his feet. With 2, he would fly. This vision is a vision of God, high and mighty, whether those adjectives apply to the throne or to God. Regardless, God is high and mighty above the temple. And his otherworldly characteristic, his sense of being above the temple, is emphasized by these very unusual seraphim who surround him. Now, what exactly are seraphim? That's a very interesting question. This is the first time that the word seraphim is used to refer to angels. Normally, the word seraphim refers to fiery serpents. But here, it clearly refers to some group of heavenly beings who stand above God, who are winged, who stand above God on the sides, and who are winged. And yet, despite their position of being above God, they are clearly subservient to God. We see that from the attitude and aspect they assume in facing God. Rather than facing him brazenly, they hide their faces, they hide their feet. Thus, they have 6 wings, because they need 2 to fly with, and then they hide their faces, they hide their feet. They are embarrassed, they are abashed, they are taken aback at God's presence, and they need to show their reverence for God by hiding themselves. It's in some way similar to the narrative of the appearance of the fire of God in the Mishkan in the Torah, where we see that people fall on their faces when they see the fire appearing in the Mishkan. Here too, the seraphim emphasize God's magnificence and majesty in the way that they fall on, they hide their faces and hide their feet when they're in his presence. The same time as they do that, they are not rendered mute, but rather they say a sentence with which we are very familiar from the tefillah.
V'kara ze el ze ve'amar, kadosh 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 Adonai Tzevaot, melochol ha'aretz kivodo.
One calls to the other and they declare, God is thrice holy, the God of legions is thrice holy, filling the whole world is his glory. What exactly are they saying when they say that God is thrice holy? Why the three-time repetition of kadosh, kadosh, kadosh? The issue is engaged by the Radak, who writes as follows. Kineged shlosha olamot, the three repetitions of kadosh represent the three worlds. Olam ha'elyon, the upper world, which is inhabited by angels, by souls. In other words, by those beings which have no physical form. Olam ha'tichon, v'hu olam ha'galgalim v'akochavim, the middle world, which is the world of the stars and of the galaxies, in other words, those non-terrestrial beings which have form, v'olam ha'shafel hu zeh ha'olam, and the lower world, which is our world. And the most honorable element in our world, of course, is human beings. And the three-time repetition of kadosh indicates that God is above all these worlds, in two of the worlds, namely the upper world, that of the angels, the middle world, that of the stars, God is sanctified and glorified with praise, and we human beings in this lower world also have an obligation to do so. That is the lesson, according to him, of Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Now, how does that lesson relate to the simple meaning of these verses? Well, it does really relate to the simple meaning in a very nice way, because the verses describe God as, on the one hand, being present in the temple, which is certainly part of this world. At the same time, he is somehow above the temple, and he is surrounded by angels who clearly do not belong in the temple. The angels are from a higher world. And so the prophecy is, in some sense, of God transcending worlds, moving between the upper world and the lower world, being in the temple while yet being surrounded by angels. This idea of the temple and the angels coming together is emphasized in the very next pasuk. Vayanu amot hasipim mikol hakorev habayit yimale ashan. The pillars of the doors shake from the calling out voice of the voice of the angels. The house is filled was filled with smoke, or would be filled with smoke. What does the filling of the house with smoke have to do with the voice of the angels? It indicates that on some level the angels' call has some effect in the physical world. The temple is filled with smoke. It is not possible to directly visualize God. Another interesting aspect of the formulations of the prophet in these first four verses is that they include past tense verbs mixed with present tense verbs and future tense verbs. We have vayanu, which is a past tense, they moved, with vav haipuch. We have yimale, which appears to be what we call a future tense, really a present. And we have what we call the present tense in the verb omdim. And all of these indicate that there is some sort of mixture of tenses going on here. That mixture of tenses is interestingly indicated in one of the Targumic interpretations of this pasuk. The Targum, when it tries to understand why there are three mentions of the word kadosh, indicates God is sanctified in the heavens, God is sanctified on earth, and then God is sanctified eternally. That aspect of eternity is how the Targum understands the third mention of kadosh, and it's something that ties into the formulations in these verses. This vision does not only leave the angels abashed, it also leaves the prophet abashed. And that is expressed in Pasuk Hei, when the prophet says as follows, Oy li ki nidmeti, ki ish tmei svatayim anochi, v'toch am tmei svatayim anochi yoshev, ki ata melech Hashem tzvakot ra'u enai. The prophet, upon hearing this voice, is scared that he might die, and he says, "Oh, woe is me, that I am destroyed, For I am a man of impure lips, and I live among a nation of impure lips. And I have seen the King, the Lord, the God of hosts.
As the verse indicates, the prophet is here, seems to be somewhat critical of the people, speaks of them as a people who are of impure lips, and the rabbis are critical of the prophet for using this formulation. But it's difficult to understand exactly what it is the prophet means here. It seems easiest to understand the prophet himself is abashed. He recognizes the great distance between himself as a mortal, as an ephemeral being, whose lips are impure in the sense that he is part of this world, and yet he has been privileged with his vision of God who is transcendent. Upon articulating this fear, his impurity seems to be removed. Vayaof elai echad min hasirafim, uviyado ritzpa, v'melkachayim lakach me'al hamizbeach. Vayaga al pi vayomer, hine nagaze al sifatecha, v'sar avonecha v'chatatecha tuchupar. One of these seraphim flew to me. In his hand was a coal. With tongs he had taken it from upon the altar. He touched my mouth and he said, Behold, this has touched your lips. Your sin will be removed. Your iniquity will be forgiven. This is a fascinating vision in which the prophet's sin is somehow purified by this coal taken from the altar. What is that sin? Perhaps that sin is the prophet's statement that he considers the people to be of impure lips. But regardless of exactly how we understand these verses, they move us into the second scene of the chapter, the scene in which the prophet and God engage in a sort of dialogue. The dialogue begins with God's command to the prophet, and it is because of this verse, which we're about to read, that this chapter is sometimes considered to be the very first one of Yeshayahu's prophecies. Verse 8, Va'ishma et kol Hashem omer, et mi eshlach, umi yelech lanu, va'omar, hinani, shlacheni. I heard the voice of God saying, Whom shall I send? Who will go for us? And I said, Here am I, send me. The prophet's eagerness to undertake this mission contrasts sharply with the unwillingness of such prophets as Moshe and Yirmiyahu to undertake prophecies from God. But because the prophet here volunteers for a mission, this chapter is sometimes considered, as I noted, to be the first one of Yeshayahu's prophecies. Because here he says, yes, I will go for this mission. The response of God here is both enigmatic and engaging. In Pasuk Tet, we begin a statement of God which lasts two Pasukim and which has been the subject of a great deal of interpretation. God says as follows in response to the prophet's willingness and eagerness to undertake the mission. Vayomer, lech ve'amarta la'am hazeh, shim'u shamoa ve'al tavinu, ur'u ra'o ve'al teda'u, hashmein lev ha'am hazeh ve'oznav hachbed ve'enav hasha. פן יראה ועיניו, ובאוזניו ישמע, ולבבו יבין, ושב ורפא לו. God said, Go and speak to this people. Listen, indeed, but do not understand. See, indeed, but do not know. Fatten the heart of this people, and make their ears heavy, and plaster their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, and with their ears they will hear, and with their heart they will understand, and they will return, and they shall be healed. These verses make very clear that God does not want the people to be healed. He does not want the people to return. The prophet is told, speak to the people, but let them not understand. Let them see, but let them not know. Make their hearts heavy, make their ears heavy, make their eyes plastered. Why is the prophet here told to speak to the people and yet not allow them to understand? This is a very difficult prophecy, and several answers have been given. I will discuss two answers which appear in the commentary of the Radak.
He first begins with an explanation which he develops elsewhere in Tanakh. It is the idea that at certain times a person or a group of people can sin so much that the opportunity of tshuva is denied to them. He argues that this is the case with Paro in Egypt, where God hardens his heart and does not let him obey God because he has sinned so much and he has denied God so many times that he no longer has the option to do tshuva. He must be punished and receive his punishment, be an example to others of how one is punished if one denies God, and only then is the opportunity of tshuva given. And Radak analogizes the behavior of the Jewish people here to the behavior of Paro in Egypt. He analogizes it also to the behavior of the sons of Eli in the book of Shmuel, where we are told that they did evil, and then God wished to kill them. Why? Because they had done so much evil that the opportunity of tshuva was denied to them. Here too, the Jewish people are being denied the opportunity of tshuva. Despite the fact that the Radak advances this option, he doesn't seem entirely pleased with it, because he then advances another option, which he introduces with the words v'yesh lefaresh. In other words, one should interpret as follows. One should interpret differently. His second interpretation is more theologically palatable, but it does violence to the grammar of the verses. He understands as follows. When the verses say shim'u shamoa ve'al tavinu, the verses say listen but do not understand, this is not to be understood as a command, although the grammar requires that it be understood that way, but rather it should be understood as a description of the Jewish people's behavior. The Radak says as follows. You are listening with your ears to the words of the prophets, but you do not understand. You see the miracles of God, but you do not wish to know. In other words, you yourselves are making the decision not to do tshuva. This is an interesting interpretation, but it is somewhat difficult to fit with the grammar of the verses. Let us conclude the last couple of verses of this prophecy, and I will suggest a possible avenue in which we might be able to understand these verses. Pasuk 11, in response to this terrible tiding, in which the Jewish people are being told to hear and to listen, but not to understand and not to do tshuva, the prophet asks God why. Va'omar, ad matai Hashem? Vayomer, ad asher imshau arim me'en yoshev uvatim me'en adam v'ha'adama tisha'esh shemama v'rechak Hashem et ha'adam v'raba ha'azuva bekerev ha'aretz. The prophet asks God, until when, God, will this happen? God responds, until cities are desolate with no inhabitants and houses without people, and the land will be desolate and abandoned. God will cause men to be far away, and there will be much abandonment in the midst of the land. These verses describe a reality which did in fact obtain in the time of the prophet. The reality of abandonment of a land, the reality of exile, came into stark relief for the first time at the time of the prophet Yeshayahu, the end of the 8th century BCE, when Assyrian kings, most notably Tiglath-Pileser III, began the policy of forced exile in order to enforce Assyrian domination on countries. The Assyrian army would arrive to countries which refused to accept Assyrian domination, would forcibly remove up to 20% of the population, forcibly deport them thousands of miles to other areas of the Assyrian Empire, and effectively eliminate that people as an ethnic group for centuries. In other words, the idea of the land being abandoned was something that really happened in the time of the prophet. But here, very interestingly, who is it who is effecting this abandonment? Pasuk 12 text tells us very clearly, V'richak Hashem et ha'adam, V'raba ha'azuva bekerev ha'aretz. It is God who will cause men to go far away. In other words, it is God who is actually acting. The Assyrians may be effecting the exile, but it is God who stands behind them. This may perhaps give us some idea of how to understand verses 10 and 11. Keeping in mind the idea that this prophecy as a whole should be understood was the prophet's vision, Ba'aspaklarya She'ina Meira, in a mirror which is somehow cloudy, in the sense that the prophet is here seeing God, in the sense that he's understanding how God operates in the world, rather than beholding God in enough himself. And so these verses might tell us something about how God operates in the world and about the nature of the interaction between God and the political forces at play in Yeshayahu's world. Because verses 10 and 11 might perhaps be understood as a reference to a trick that the Assyrian Empire would often play on those countries that it sought to threaten. And I speak of it as a trick from our point of view, but from the Assyrian point of view, it was really something very astute politically. The Assyrian practice was to demand tribute from all conquered nations, or from nations who were threatened in some way by the Assyrian army. The tribute did not consist solely of taxes, but involved a ceremony of presentation of tribute, in which officials from the various kingdoms would gather every year in the month of Adar and present the tribute ceremonially in the palace of the Assyrian king in the Assyrian capital, usually at Kalach. The ceremony of presentation involved an extremely effective and specifically designed technique, which we might today call brainwashing. The tribute bearers were received in the Assyrian capital, were then led through a series of rooms in the palace, which contained artwork designed to show the visitors how very powerful and mighty the Assyrian king was. The artwork included scenes of the Assyrian king receiving tribute from the farthest away nations. It included scenes of the Assyrian king conquering and devastating enemies in terrifying and fearsome battles. And it included a scene of the Assyrian king seated on a throne, high and mighty, while multiply winged fish-like creatures surrounded him on both sides. These emissaries who brought the tribute were then sent back to their home countries with a message. Go back to your home countries, they were told, and convince your locals to be loyal to the Assyrian Empire, to be loyal to Assyria and never to rebel. The objective was to convince all the nations who brought tribute that the Assyrian Empire was some sort of superhuman force which could never be defeated. And perhaps this is how Psukim Yud and Yud Aleph should be understood. The prophet is speaking about a voice that comes forth from God, but it is in a sense the voice that God allows the Assyrian army, the Assyrian Empire, to express. Cause people's hearts to be fat, this voice says. Cause people's ears to be heavy. Cause their eyes to be plastered. Let them not really understand what they are seeing. In other words, these people are going to Assyria. They are seeing images of Assyrian power. What they should really understand is how very weak the Assyrians are, how very grounded in physicality their power is, and how their power is entirely dependent on that of God. And yet what they actually say when they come back from Assyria is the praises of Assyrian power. In other words, they do not really understand what it is they are seeing. Their eyes are somehow blinded. Their ears are somehow made heavy. Their eyes are somehow, and their hearts are somehow made fat. They do not really understand what they are seeing, and it is because they do not understand what they are seeing that they are not able to do tshuva, to understand that the Assyrian power ought to lead them to recognize God's power behind Assyria, ought to lead them to understand that physicality is ephemeral, and that the only truly eternal power is that of God. And because they are not able to understand this, they do not do tshuva, and they will therefore suffer the destruction that will be wrought on those who refuse to recognize God's power. It is in this sense, perhaps, that we ought to understand the connection between let them not see in Psukim 9 and 10, and then Pasuk 11 and 12, the prophecy of destruction of the land. And yet, not all the people, we are told, will engage in this type of destructive behavior. Because Pasuk 13, the concluding Pasuk of our chapter, gives a sense of hope. Ve'od ba Assyria, v'shava v'hayita leva'er. Even if there are a tenth among them left, says the prophet, they shall return, they shall be destroyed. This is not the hopeful part, but it is the end of the Pasuk that is more hopeful. Ka'ela v'cha'alon asher b'shalechet matzevet bam, Zera Kodesh Matzavta. Just as the terebinth and the oak, which even when their leaves fall, their trunk remains, the holy seed is her trunk. Who is the her here? The her perhaps is the nation of Israel. There will remain that Zera Kodesh, that holy seed, those who do not become subservient to the Assyrian Empire, those who recognize that behind the power of Assyria is the eternal power of God. Those in whom fear of blood of flesh and blood engenders fear of heaven. This corresponds to the statement of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in Brachot that may the fear of God be in you at least as much as the fear of human kingdoms. And so those who are able to internalize this message, they are the Zera Kodesh. They are the holy seed out of whom the rejuvenation of the Jewish people will proceed.